and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, you could say it's been quite the comeback. Just weeks after the spreading coronavirus shook financial markets around the globe, U.S. equity markets have found their way back to record highs, and risk seems to be back in vogue. Would you say it's justified, or should investors likely be wary of the rally?
And if you only came here for the big reveal of the craziest things we saw in markets this week, don't worry. We will close the show with that tradition. Sarah, bad news for you again this week. I'm afraid.
You're the winner once again.
I won. I think I got
1 week of reprieve. Yeah. 1 week of you saying that you don't automatically win the title.
Right. I'm back to winning again, guaranteed.
All right. Well,
I don't know. Maybe
we're
going
to bring the challenge.
Maybe our guests will surprise us with some even crazier things, but mine's pretty good. But joining us for the first time on the show, very happy to have him, Barry Gill, head of investments at UBS Asset Management. Barry, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, Mike.
And also joining us from the Bloomberg Consumer team, she's a reporter, an editor, wears many hats, is Bloomberg Sally Bakewell. Sally, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Barry, let's start with you. Am I right to be sort of shocked at how resilient the stock market is given the events going on in China?
I guess I'm a little surprised it snapped back as quickly as it has, but I think everybody is alert. They're trying to play the map from SARS. Everybody understands how long that took to play out. So there's a little bit of jumping the gun. But as soon as people anticipated that things were going to move into the second derivative and start to flatten out in terms of new cases getting announced, the risk appetite is there. All the fundamentals are pretty broadly bullish. And people have continued to be underinvested in this equity bull market. So in some ways, it doesn't surprise me.
It's been made pretty clear that, sure, people like to compare the current coronavirus to the likes of SARS back in late 2002, 2003, but the times were very different. But you alluded to the fact that SARS took a much longer time for it to really run its course through financial markets. Do you get the sense that, sure, this is behind us, we don't yet know whether or not the virus has peaked yet? Or do you get the sense that, no, the probability is that volatility is going to continue, big moves don't happen in a vacuum, and we can't completely call the all clear just yet?
Look, I think there's a little bit of hope going on that the containment efforts have sort of cauterized the problem earlier than, if you go back to SARS, and this is obviously the only event that we can sort of in our investment memory that we can go back to, so we may overplay the analogy. But then there was a cover-up going on. There's been pretty much full disclosure taking place this time. The challenge, I think, coming out of this particular problem is that because the reaction has been as swift as it has, the likely impact on GDP is potentially even greater, particularly in Asia. And you're seeing data points coming out to support that than people had anticipated. So there may be a little bit of bad news associated with the reporting of that going forward. But my guess is that everything happens these days and gets priced in a heck of a lot quicker than it would have done 15 or 20 years ago. And as a result, I think it's just going to play out just fine.
Right. So sort of a bitter medicine for, excuse the really bad pun, as far as the economy goes, quarantining these cities, basically shutting down, it seems like, a huge chunk of the consumer economy. And I know, reading one of your recent notes, you sounded pretty bullish about China, especially the consumer in China becoming more affluent,
right,
more sort of a domestic-focused economy rather than an export-focused economy. Does this just delay that sort of progress, or is there any chance of any sort of permanent or semi-permanent damage to consumer confidence in China?
I don't think there is a recipe for that at all. I think the trends taking place in China are inexorable in nature. They're truly structural. The growing middle class, the focus on the domestic economy. There's a lot of things going on. There's a real break there's a sort of a bifurcation that's taking place in the market there. But I'm bullish both on the consumerization of the Chinese economy, the premiumization phenomenon that's taking place there as people get wealthier, and then a whole bunch of disruptive things that are taking place from the technology standpoint over there. And I think that those are going to play out over the next 10 or 20 years, and nothing like this will get in the way. In fact, if anything, you could argue that one of the lessons, that, and this is not directed directly at the consumer element of the economy, but when you have an event like this and you have to shut down factories, and what you figure out is, well, hang on a second, we now have people in these factories, we've now just shut down the productive capacity of a region because of this event. How do we actually figure out how to automate from here? So in some ways, it's going to accelerate some trends that are already in place.
One stat I saw that was amazing to me, Bloomberg Economics, Tom Ehrlich, the head of Bloomberg Economics, kind of lowered his forecast for first quarter GDP growth to about 4.5%. Mm-hmm. It was 6% at the end of last year. Right. So slow by China's standards, but it's amazing to me that there could be any growth at all in this economy in this quarter, given what we're seeing on TV, and yet twice the pace of the U.S. growth still. It's just remarkable. It's this engine of growth, regardless of the fact that it's slowing.
Well, this goes back to the earlier point that I was making. I think we likely underestimate the severity of the impact in this quarter. So we've had the snapback in the market. Then you're going to report on the real data. It's probably a little bit more, it's probably potentially significantly more pronounced in the first quarter as a result of this, but then the snapback will be equally hard when things stabilize.
Right. We haven't yet gotten the economic data that shows the period that encompasses the virus. And as we start to get that through February, we will start to see it. Say there's a possibility that it comes through worse than expected. We see another bout of volatility shake markets really around the globe. Because you are bullish on China, would you say that's an opportunity for you to look for opportunity, and where would that actually be in that event?
Absolutely. It's very likely that when that reporting takes place of past data, it's actually coinciding with real-time data in terms of new cases, et cetera, getting announced. And the market is a forward-looking mechanism, and it will spend a lot more time focused on that second derivative kicking in rather than the reporting of the bad data. In fact, once you get over the data, it really gives the all clear to the market, because we can't really see any other major hiccups that could affect it from there, at least over the next few months.
Sally, when it comes to U.S. consumer companies that are your focus, it's hard to even think of a company that is not somehow exposed to China, either as a supplier or as a customer. And I know you've just been typing your fingers this week with trying to cover it all. But what are some of the highlights of what the consumer companies are saying about the virus?
Yeah, I have no fingers left now. Well, I think it's been a really interesting week, because U.S. companies have now had a bit of time to digest and see how it's going to play out. And that corresponded with a busy week for earnings, where they have had to talk about the impact, because they can't really get away with not. Enough time has passed for them to need to be able to show they can do that. And so we have had companies like Capri, which is the owner of Jimmy Choo, Versace, Tapestry, which owns Coach and Kate Spade, and Estee Lauder is another one. And they have started to say how it is going to impact their sales and profit this year. A few of them have reduced their guidance for revenue, their profit forecasts for this year. And for a lot of them, actually, their China business isn't huge, but they have invested significantly into the country because, as you mentioned, it's got this rising middle class, and they want to make sure they can capture that opportunity. And so that, I think, is why it's a big deal for these companies, and why they are expressly seeing a dent.
When companies have come out and given a forecast for the future, have they been relatively open-ended? I think of Apple, for example. When they reported earnings, they just gave a wider range than expected, because it's very difficult to actually estimate at this point in time what the true fallout was going to be. I know Starbucks has made clear how many stores are closed, and Nike said they will feel a material impact from the coronavirus. But do we actually have a sense yet of what the numerical impact could be to a couple or many of these companies' bottom lines, and what that might mean across the board?
Yes. Some have given specific amounts of profit impact. Others, like Starbucks, you mentioned, have said, we don't know the impact, and we can't assess it, so we're not going to incorporate it in our guidance, so have our guidance as it should have been and as it was. And that obviously makes it difficult for investors, and perhaps it's why we saw with the companies that I mentioned earlier, you know, Capri, Estee Lauder, Tapestry, they all saw their shares lift because they had otherwise good news or relatively decent news. But this great unknown and this threat, which they tried to address, I mean, they all mentioned that there might be an impact, that didn't seem to really hit the share price at all.
Yeah, that was almost one of my craziest things I saw this week. Story you worked
on. Have I scooped you?
No. But he basically said this company, that company, and this company all came out and said this is going to have a material impact on earnings. And their stocks all rallied after the news.
They were honest, truthful.
So I can almost imagine, you know, when the first quarter numbers come out, you could imagine some sort of earnings ex coronavirus impact being reported. I mean, is it going to be as simple as that, Barry? I mean, is the market going to accept that to take, you know, basically ignore some bad numbers for a quarter, whether it be the economic data and earnings, or could it cause a little bit of jitters?
The market is pretty good at separating what's an exceptional event from what's a structural change, the dynamic. I'll tell you, if there's a reacceleration in cases or something like that, then, and this starts to look like a Q2 phenomenon, then people will start to think about it very, very differently. But I think for the moment, given the risk appetite in the market, people are going to just look right through it.
You mentioned earlier on that the fundamentals are moving to the upside. And something that's really stood out to me through this earnings season is the fact that if you look at 2020 forecasted EPS, it's pretty much hung in there at 8.5%. We haven't really seen the deterioration that you typically see when you enter a new year. So can you give us a sense, sure, maybe profits are hanging in there, even amid all these worries considering the coronavirus, but what is it that does cause you to be so bullish as it relates to fundamentals across the board?
Oh, look, I mean, we discounted a lot of stuff in 2019, snapped back from a very low level, really, at the end of 2018. But a lot of the things that people were really worried about in 2018, they've kind of passed, right? And if anything, I would say, sitting here looking at 2020, things like the recession risk that people were fearful of, it's a lower probability in 2020 now than it was maybe in 2018, 2019. You've had the loosening of financial policy by the Fed and really across the board for central banks. So that takes time to flow into the broad economy as well, call it a 6 to 9 month lag. So that's feeding into 2020 as well. And then think about all the things that were going on in the manufacturing economy associated with trade last year and for parts of 2018. And we've had at least a step one resolution, which gives companies the ability to plan a little bit further. So all of the manufacturing markers were really sort of bottoming out and starting to tip up. For me, the big shock has been the impact. I mean, we really thought that we were going to have an acceleration in growth, and the coronavirus, amongst other things, primarily the virus, has really held everything back. And so the move in the 10-year has been dramatic. The initial move in the equity markets has been dramatic. But those underlying cyclical dynamics will play out over the course of the year. And as long as this is a one-off event, they should be the dominant factor for the subsequent three quarters. And that's why I don't think you see a lot of move in the earnings estimates at the moment, because you could kind of, once people ring fence it, there are so many other variables going on and people are reasonably conservative. You should be okay hitting those numbers by the end of the year.
You know, you mentioned the 10-year yield, and obviously you did a great job of explaining why the equity market might be able to look past this. Some of the other markets still seem a little cautious. Oil, obviously, I mean, they have to contend with just the obvious supply and demand issues going on because of this. But that 10-year yield is still sort of closer to the lower end of the range we've seen. I mean, it's something like, closer to 2 towards the end of the year. Started rolling over even before the coronavirus, got to about 1.5. It's now about 165. Is that just the nature of the bond market to be a little bit more pessimistic about the future, or is that a cause of concern for an equity outlook?
Look, this is a question that I sort of grapple with on an ongoing basis, because all of the things cyclically seem to be pointing towards more labor bargaining power, tighter labor capacity, slightly more optimism. All of these things are a recipe for increased inflation across the broad economy.
The Phillips curve's not dead, you say?
Not dead.
All
what's
right.
The term? Kinked, not dead. And I do think that is one of those things, is that you don't see any change for a long time, and then you see a lot of change very, very quickly. But I think there is this structural bias. The low rate or the lower for longer phenomenon has been with us for so long that every time you get a hiccup like we've just had, it sucks people back into that story. And there are there's a powerful secular argument around low rates, which would be, in simple terms, forget about the low growth story, but in simple terms, the internet disintermediate, or really the internet being a deflator on the services economy, which is obviously 70% of GDP. But that's a really, really long-term phenomenon.
Yeah.
In the medium term, these major cyclical factors that I've talked about really should be the things that play out. But there is momentum to that legacy story, and I think it's going to take some real optimism and a real broad cyclical uplift to sort of break the back of that. But frankly, I'm stunned at where the tenure is at this point.
All right. Well, I think it's that time, Sarah.
It is that time.
All right. I know you got a crazy thing from a listener of the show. Why don't you start with that?
We did. So we actually had a terminal client reach out. He goes by the name of David Back. He's a credit analyst in Virginia. And what he said was, it's rare to see a firm reorganize under Chapter 11 and reemerge in a completely different line of business. Children's clothing retailer Gymboree announced plans to exit bankruptcy protection and begin anew as, anyone have a guess?
I'm going to say a blockchain biotechnology company focused on coronavirus vaccines.
It's a very good guess, but unfortunately,
that's what
you're
I would
wrong.
Reorganize as.
No, you're very wrong. But as an artwork authentication service.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Why not? Why not? Right? There's
a
natural connection between children's clothing and artwork authentication. But it was a really good example, and just very interesting, trying to give you insight into how companies try to reorganize themselves to stay relevant, stay alive.
That's pretty good. I encourage that guy to reach out to us again.
Thank you, David. We appreciate it.
I might have to rethink. No, I stole one. I stole one. Sorry, David.
We'll see about that.
Sally, did they tell us? I know I told you about our gimmick here, the craziest thing. What do you have for us?
I wondered if you would mind if I substituted the word crazy with beautiful.
Sure.
Go for it.
Crazy beautiful.
Crazy beautiful. Yeah, yes. So we had Peloton announcing its second quarter results this week, and guidance for its next quarter missed estimates and the shares slid. But some analysts who I think must all own Pelotons got really quite poetic with their notes. And one of them wrote that the company was climbing the hills of worry with a steady cadence in reference to its stationary bicycles. And then another who wrote that upside in the second quarter was in part at the expense of the third quarter as faster order to delivery time shifted units forward. However, the analyst said not to sweat the shift.
Oh, boy.
They
oh boy.
Love to
Sell
get
side has too much time on their hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, too much time.
I think they're just...
They love the puns.
They're just fishing to get the headline one of our in one of our headlines.
And they just got it.
Yes. But
and
the
they
truth, got it. Yeah. Oh. And the truth
Winners.
Is,
fell into
it works.
That's right, right.
It fell
right
in.
Was there any impact from that very controversial commercial for Peloton on sales?
I think the main impact was on my productivity and the productivity of my colleagues when
and
we discussed it at length.
The amount of memes or GIFs that I saw over the past week before Peloton did report earnings with the woman from the commercial space.
All publicity is good publicity.
Yeah. It's very true.
Especially
it's
for
very
that woman.
True.
She got all sorts of acting
yes,
gigs
she did.
After that. So, and probably got a free bike out of it, I imagine. All right. Barry, pretty stiff competition, and we haven't even gotten to mine yet. So
I can't go down the beautiful route. I guess, it's kind of the elephant in the room. I've been One of the arguments that I've been using when I've been thinking about the equity markets in particular is that we've never had a real period of speculation and optimism in the market. There's been isolated pockets of it, right, where things, and certainly 2017 was a period of a lot of multiple expansion. But I would say the dynamic in Tesla's stock in the last few days for a very large cap company is one of the strangest things that I've seen. And it's certainly, for somebody who's sort of been structurally bullish, I'm very, very much this cycle. I've been wanted to buy we want to buy the dips, and you want to stay invested until you see the same levels of commitment and optimism that you see typically at the end of other cycles. When you see events like that, you either ask, is there a market structure issue going on, or is there some sort of level of speculation that I haven't picked up broadly? And so you watch situations like that to figure out if there's sort of signal in the noise. And I can't parse it at the moment, but it was certainly odd.
I agree. That was bizarre. It's the type of thing you see in like a penny stock where it only takes a few thousand bucks to move
unbelievable. I mean, I heard the 1999 comparison thrown out there a few times this week. But I think anytime you see a stock jump that much, especially the likes of Tesla, which was an extremely heavily shorted company, very polarizing, it definitely captured everyone's attention.
Let me be very clear. This is nothing like 1999.
Yeah. But the fact that this is what at least spurred comparisons. But yeah, very still different.
Right. All right. Well, I've got two crazy things. A bonus one. I'm allowed a bonus crazy thing, right?
Do I get to go?
Oh, you go first. Yeah.
Right. Just because I'm tacking on to Barry as well. So sure, Tesla shares did surge, but Luke Kawa, our colleague, pointed out and looked into the options market. And if you had bought calls on Tesla that paid out at $1,000, then your investment would have risen 9,800% through.
That would be good.
Which would be good. I saw a couple Reddits about Tesla with people posting how much they had made by buying call options on Tesla. Call it luck, call it whatever you want to. But some serious money was made.
I wonder if they bought the puts then on the way down afterwards.
or if they lost it all because they were too stubborn.
Well, that's pretty good. All right. Well, let me give you my bonus crazy thing. It's that guy, the junk bond trader at Citigroup in London. Guy makes £1 million a year. And they caught him stealing snacks from the cafeteria. So they suspended a million pound a year junk bond trader for stealing snacks. So that was pretty good. But that is not the craziest thing. The craziest thing, it actually, I'm kind of cheating because I got this from Cameron Christ, our columnist, but I added him. So I feel like I can kind of claim his crazy things. And it's about the Baltic Dry Index. You know, it's the index of prices for cargo ships. People very often, Barry, I don't know if you've ever done this, but people try to sort of force this sort of macro signal onto it when you really shouldn't, because of it's super volatile and there's sort of, you know, supply and demand issues within the shipping industry. Fuel prices are a big deal this year. They're moving to a more environmentally friendly fuel. Mm-hmm. But if you were to take this as a macro indicator, it would look like the Great Depression right now. The thing is just completely collapsed. It one day...
Oh, was it a 100% decline or something of the sort?
The Baltic Cape Size Index fell 99% one day. But here's... That's not even the crazy part. Here's the crazy part is there's this website called Splash247. I'm sure you read it, Splash247.
Never heard of it. Never heard of it, Mike.
It's an industry website that tracks these things. And they tracked what's called backhaul cargo ships. And they found that the rates for backhaul cargo ships were negative $11,000 a day. So it's like the negative yielding bond of the shipping world. In other words, you could charter out your boat to someone and you'd have to pay them $11,000 a day to do it. And I was trying to wrap my head around why this possibly could be.
It's the idea that people don't want to move into a region that,
well, go on.
I think move into it. A region in which you have a virus that is spreading. So if people don't want to go there, you would potentially have to pay them to go.
I think that is a big part of it. It's they call it.
It's good thinking. Maybe.
Ships repositioning. So I guess the cargo lines from say L.A. to Asia have just been shut down for now. And so these ships are repositioning from the Pacific to the Atlantic. So for that privilege, the owner has to pay someone 11 grand basically to move them. So right. If only I knew how to drive a boat, I'd be
you're going to get into the business? So Mike's going to be gone next week. He'll be calling in from a ship in the middle of the ocean.
11 grand a day. I'm going to go get my...
I like the London Trader story better.
Okay.
They're both good.
That's pretty good.
They're both good. Would you say it's enough for him to win, though?
Definitely not.
And Barry's opinion might matter
Anyone
more.
But Mike.
Wait, who's the judge?
Me.
Oh, Mike is the judge.
Yes,
Mike
and I
makes himself
win.
The judge, sure, and he always says he wins.
So. I feel that this is a flawed process.
A little bit of a biased competition.
They're all
it was
good.
Never
all
even
good.
Really supposed to be a competition.
Yeah, but then I just kept winning, so I was like,
yeah. But with that said, they were all good this week.
Yeah, it's good. Four way tie.
Yeah, but we'll leave it there for now. Sally, Barry, thank you so much for coming on the show
this week. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
What Goes Out will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reganonymous. And you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.